The R.R. Campbell Writes Cast is brought to you in part by listeners like you. Learn more about the great rewards available to Writes Cast contributors by visiting patreon.com/writescast. Thanks for listening. Over the course of a week or a month or a year, each of us lives through countless real-life scenes, the most memorable of which become the stories we share among friends, with family, or in our blog posts. But what is it about those moments that makes them so memorable, and how can we use our understanding of them to improve our scene structure as writers? Hey there, I'm R.R. Campbell, and welcome to episode 13 of the R.R. Campbell Writescast. Before we get started, I want to thank everyone who voted on Twitter to make scene structure the topic for this bonus episode of the show. If you'd like to have a say in the focus points of future bonus installments of the WritesCast, be sure to follow IamRRCampbell or WritesCast on Twitter and watch for future polls where I'll ask you what you'd like to hear about next. Over the course of this episode, I'll explore what I consider to be the four core components of any successful scene, as well as what we can do as writers to make sure we maximize the effectiveness of each component and scene itself. Before we hop into that discussion, however, I'd like to announce to listeners that my flash fiction piece, Wool, is now available to read and listen to through 521 Magazine. Wool is the short story of a young boy's first unexpected experience with poverty, and it can be found on 521's website in their The Sideshow section. I'd love to hear from you once you've had a chance to check it out, so feel free to reach out to me on Twitter at IamRRCampbell or by getting in touch through my website's contact page at rrcampbellwrites.com. Also, in keeping up with a new tradition on the show, I'd like to give a shout out to Stephanie Simpson on Twitter, who tweets at Simpson_romance. Recently, Steph had this to say about the R.R. Campbell WritesCast. Follow Twitter handle WritesCast for great podcasts and perspectives on writing and the business thereof. Well, thanks, Steph, for that review. I hope this and all future episodes of the show can live up to those expectations. Now it's your turn, dear listeners. Take to Twitter and leave your feedback on the show at #WritesCast for your chance at a shout-out in a future episode. I'd love to hear what you have to say. All right, let's get to the matter at hand. As I mentioned earlier, we'll be talking about the four core components of a scene today and exploring each in detail, step by step. With that in mind, let's return to the premise that there are scenes in our own personal lives that prove more memorable than others. What is it about our strongest memories that sets them apart from break room small talk or time spent monitoring the most recent fluctuations in the meme economy? After taking some time to reflect on this, I'm confident you'll arrive at similar answers to my own. That conflict, emotion, and change moments are what separate moments forgotten from the moments that define our days, those of others, and ultimately who we are as people. When we're writing, then, we should strive to create scenes that transcend the mundane. We want to present readers with the stories that define our characters. That is to say, we want to describe the very tale that those characters would include in their own autobiographies or memoirs. More often than not, those scenes will be those that force our characters to make decisions that balance their needs against those of others. In focusing on those scenes, we create opportunities for plot advancement as well as character definition and growth. On the broadest level, this is all fine and good, but unless we know how to execute on these ideas, we're just speaking in broad platitudes that may or may not lead to actual results. How do we ensure our scenes serve these greater purposes, then? Well, we do so by having each scene incorporate what I consider to be the four core components to scene structure. All right, make sure your pens are full, your pencils are sharp, and your typing fingers are stretched out, because here are those four core components in list form. The four core components to scene structure are goal, conflict, resolution, and cliffhanger. On the surface, each of these might seem rather self-explanatory. As we dive into each one in detail, however, we'll discover there are more dimensions to each than one might anticipate at first glance. So let's begin right away then with goal, the first core component to scene structure. Kurt Vonnegut once said, "All characters should want something, even if it's only a glass of water." When most folks hear that quote, there's a tendency to focus on the glass of water itself. It seems a bit absurd at first, considering that for most of us, water is obtained with a simple turn of the tap, and we're always told that high stakes are imperative to the advancement of any scene. So what's with the water? Well, high stakes are a pivotal part of our narrative arcs as a whole, But even the most ordinary wants or needs can lead to the creation of a compelling scene if all the other core components of scene structure are intact. We've established that in Vonnegut's quote, it's easy to focus on the glass of water, but the most important words in that quote, in my view at least, are actually the words, all characters. That's right. The creation of a quality scene isn't driven by the goals of our perspective character alone, but rather the sum of goals each character on the page has, no matter how large or small the role of the character in question may be. In fact, it's through understanding each character's primary goal that we find our way into the second core component of scene structure, namely, conflict. It should go without saying that we want tension on the page, but how do we ensure our pages remain tense without a constant barrage of battle scenes or shouting matches? Well, we do so by relying on the goals we've established as part of the first core component to scene structure. The key in executing on these first two core components lies in the dependence they have on one another. When establishing our characters' goals at the start of a scene, we ought to ask ourselves, do these characters' goals complement or compete with the goals of other characters? Where competing goals are concerned, conflict can be directly derived through the establishment of a simple axiom that lies at the core of narrative tension. One character wants something, another character wants something else. Or maybe both characters even want the same thing. The point is, though, and this is crucial for ensuring conflict arises in scenes that feature competing goals, both characters can't get what they want. In setting up our scenes in a way that won't allow both characters to get exactly what they desire, we're ensuring that all characters involved in the conflict, and ergo, our readers, will have a vested interest in the scene, which will now be rooted in conflict and emotional tension. Of course, there are plenty of scenes over the course of our manuscripts where our primary antagonizing forces aren't present. How do we inject conflict into scenes where allies are plotting or getting to better know one another? You guessed it. That's where complementary goals come into play. Let's take an example from the A Song of Ice and Fire series, or Game of Thrones if you're more familiar with the show. Now, there'll be some light spoilers ahead, of course, so if you haven't read through the third book or watched the fourth season of the show, my apologies. I'll try to include only information that's absolutely essential to this analysis of scene structure. For the example in question, though, I want to focus on the characters of Arya Stark and the Hound, or Sandor Clegane. After the Red Wedding, the two of them travel from the Riverlands and toward the Vale with the common goal of reuniting Arya with her Aunt Lysa. And there you have it. Not really even complementary goals, but an identical shared goal. As any reader of the books or watcher of the show can attest to, however, these Arya and the Hound scenes aren't exactly snooze fests. So how is it that tension remains thick in those scenes despite the common interest the two share? The answer to that question lies in motivation and execution. Why does Arya want to see her aunt in the Vale? Well, she wants to be reunited with her family and in a safe environment. And the Hound? Well, he wants to escort Arya to the Vale because he wants to trade Arya to her Aunt Lysa in exchange for gold, silver, or whatever else it is he might try to ransom her for. As a result of these differences in motivation, conflict naturally creeps its way onto the page or screen. Though those characters may never confront one another specifically about those differences in motivation, the fact that these differences exist creates a subtext for conflict and tension that leads to a dynamic that I feel becomes easily one of the most fun to read or watch in the entire series. Aside from differences in motivation, disagreements about how to achieve complementary or identical goals can lead to conflict, which, as we've established, is the second of our core components to scene structure. Because I'm an absolute monster, let's take another example from the world of Westeros, this time pulling from Season 1, or the first book, in that series. When Ned Stark is serving as King Robert Baratheon's Hand of the King, which, for those of you who are unfamiliar with the show, is a sort of co-executive where matters of policy are concerned, the two of them and the other members of the King's Council receive word that Daenerys Targaryen, one of the last living members of the family from which Robert took the throne on which he now sits, is pregnant by the great warrior and Dothraki horse lord, Khal Drogo. Both Ned and King Robert have similar goals. Ned, as Robert's right-hand man, wants to ensure the child born to Daenerys poses no threat to Robert's reign. And King Robert, of course, doesn't want his throne possibly threatened should Daenerys' child grow up to become a great warrior himself. Where Ned and the King disagree, however, is in how to achieve these complementary goals. King Robert wants Daenerys and her son murdered to eliminate any possible threat, whereas Ned counsels that Daenerys, her warrior husband, and their eventual child pose no threat so long as they're on the far side of the world. Ned still wants to help preserve Robert's reign, but he's not interested in doing so in a way that will lead to the death of an unborn child. Anyone who's familiar with the show or who has read the first book knows that the ensuing disagreement over the execution of these complementary goals leads to a deep schism between these two characters, one that both further defines character and advances the plot tremendously. And how does it do it? It does so by ensuring that our characters' goals are clear and that they themselves or the motivations behind them lead to conflict. So now we've covered both goal and conflict, which leads us to the third core component of scene structure, resolution. At first thought, one might think that a scene's resolution is the moment in which our perspective character accomplishes her goal, but it's not quite as simple as that. In fact, more often than not, especially up through the midpoint of our protagonist's narrative arc, our main character won't be accomplishing her established goal in every scene. Remember, the midpoint is where our main character goes from reactive to proactive and begins to turn the tide against her antagonizing force, which should inevitably lead to more achieving of her goals as the plot advances. Where the third core component of scene structure is concerned, then, what do we mean when we talk about resolutions exactly? Think of them this way. It's less about our perspective character getting what she wants and more about the scene itself achieving resolution. If we think back to the second core component, or conflict, we've already established that each character on the page ought to have goals of his or her own, and, as we discussed regarding competing and complementary goals, not everyone can get everything that they want all of the time. Therefore, it stands to reason that every scene won't end with every one of our characters getting exactly what they want out of it. If we can't give our characters what they want, then, how do we resolve our scenes? There are a few effective ways to do this, the first of which ties into neighboring scenes rather than the scene we are most focused on itself. Consider the resolution moment in any given scene to be a sort of springboard or launching pad for what's to come next. Though each scene tells a story in and of itself, it's really part of a greater narrative and as such needs to have connectivity to previous scenes as well as those to come. Resolutions play a major role in connecting the scene you're currently writing to the scenes that follow it in your story's chronology. In this way, any given scene's resolution should tie in directly to a future scene's goal by prompting us to ask ourselves this one question. How will the conflict of the scene we're currently writing, as well as the conflicts of previous scenes, change our character's goals and her approaches to achieving those goals going forward? The answer to that question is your scene's resolution. Perhaps as a result of the conflict in the scene, for example, your protagonist has learned something new about her antagonist, or possibly even herself. How will this new information help or hinder her approach as she advances along her narrative arc? Maybe instead the conflict of the current scene leads to a compromise between characters with complementary goals, but different motivations for achieving said goals. In these cases, the compromise the two characters reach is the scene's resolution. Simply put, we have the beginnings of a new plan that will help guide our main character and her allies as we turn the pages. Let's return to our Game of Thrones examples for a minute to explore some concrete instances of scene resolution. Remember, when Arya Stark and the Hound arrive at the Vale, their goal is to ensure Arya is delivered to her Aunt Lysa. This scene's resolution is, spoiler alert, that they fail to do so. Notice though that I haven't yet cited the reason why they fail to deliver Arya to her aunt, as we'll discuss that in a few minutes. The point is, however, that this scene, and this plot thread more generally, is resolved in this moment not with both characters having accomplished their complementary goals, but with them both failing to do so. Where Ned Stark and King Robert's disagreement over how to handle the perceived threat from across the sea is concerned, only one of these two men, if either, can emerge from the scene's conflict as the victor. And, spoiler alert, it's King Robert who emerges victorious when he decrees that other members of his council are to take actions that will lead to the death of Daenerys Targaryen and her unborn child. In this way, King Robert's decision is the resolution for this particular scene. When reflecting on both of these examples, you might find your brain either trying to remind itself what happens next, or if you're not familiar with Game of Thrones, you might find yourself asking, well, then what comes next? If either of those are happening, that's a good thing, because that's exactly what we'll be discussing in the next section, the cliffhangers or change moments for each of these scenes. Cliffhangers are the fourth and final core component to scene structure as I see it. Before we explore their use, however, I think it's important to define exactly what I mean by cliffhanger. You might recall that when mentioning cliffhangers as the fourth and final component to scene structure, I also referred to them as change moments. I did this intentionally, as I view the final component to scene structure as something of an either-or proposition. Either a scene ends with a cliffhanger, or it ends with a change moment. The lines can blur from time to time, but for the purposes of the definition, let's pretend it's a little more clear-cut. Let's think of this whole cliffhanger change moment thing in this way. Not every scene can end with our perspective character's livelihood in imminent danger. I mean, sure, you could write a cliffhanger like that into every scene, but I'm going to caution against it for one primary reason. That using the threat of death or absolute failure to end every scene will cause those cliffhanger moments to lose their effectiveness over time. If our manuscript's first 10 scenes portray our main character figuratively or even literally on the verge of drowning, for example, by the 10th scene, our readers will be able to predict exactly what's coming, and a constantly predictable manuscript is one we should generally want to avoid writing. Of course, we want our readers making predictions and feeling validated for them from time to time, but, like with all things in writing, we want to strike a balance between keeping readers well-grounded and putting them on their toes. Ending every scene with an earth-shattering cliffhanger will keep them on their toes all right, but everyone can only prop themselves up on their tiptoes for so long before they begin to tire. So what can we do instead of implementing traditional cliffhangers to end every scene? Well, we can make use of those change moments I mentioned earlier instead. When I say change moments, I'm referring specifically to events, thoughts, or other interactions that lead to either shifts in perspective, present our characters or readers with new information, or moments that otherwise change the trajectory of the events going forward. Another way to approach change moments is to think of them as the scene's real takeaway. They're the impact moment that provides a sort of bridge between one scene's resolution and the goals of future scenes. Change moments are often the fourth core component to scenes in literary fiction, as those novels tend to focus more on character change and development than they do on plot. Think about classics like The Catcher in the Rye by J.D. Salinger, or Sula by Toni Morrison. How many scenes in those books end with earth-shattering plot twists? Not many, if any at all. Rather than implement cliffhangers in scene after scene, these books rely predominantly on change moments to provide that bridge I mentioned between resolution in one scene and goal in the next or future scenes. More contemporary examples of books that implement change moments rather than traditional cliffhangers include Black Swan Green by David Mitchell and The Hate U Give by Angie Thomas. Both books do feature scenes that end in what I would consider cliffhangers, but they also incorporate plenty of scenes in which the protagonist experiences a change in perspective, learns something new, or resolves to take action that will change readers' expectation for character behavior going forward. Both books do this very effectively, despite featuring characters from vastly different time periods and backgrounds. Let's tie things up nicely then by returning to our examples from A Song of Ice and Fire or Game of Thrones. For the scenes we've been exploring as part of our analysis on scene structure, one of them concludes with a rather strong cliffhanger, whereas the other uses a change moment to propel the action forward. We'll begin with an exploration of the scene that ends with a cliffhanger first. In our scene with Ned Stark and King Robert, both men started with the same goal of ensuring threats to Robert's reign are minimized. The two men enter into conflict over how to best do this, but the king ultimately overrules Ned and gives resolution to the scene by proclaiming that a woman and her unborn child must die to accomplish the originally established goal these two men share. All of this leads to the scene's cliffhanger. Ned Stark is so opposed to the murder of a woman and child he views as innocent that he dramatically resigns from his post as Hand of the King, to which King Robert responds quite harshly. By the time the scene ends, readers or show watchers are left asking themselves, "Gods be good, what happens now? Can the relationship between these two men ever be repaired? Will Ned try to stop the plot that might lead to the murder of Daenerys Targaryen and her unborn child? What would the king do if Ned tried to do so?" All in all, there are a ton of questions that readers are left with, all the result of this dramatic, earth-shattering cliffhanger of a moment between two immensely powerful characters. In our scene with Arya and the Hound, however, both characters had the goal of getting Arya safely to her aunt's home in the Vale, but they enter into conflict at times because they have two disparate motivations for doing so. Ultimately, their journey is resolved when they fail to get Arya safely into her aunt's care, but the reason for their failure is what I consider to be a change moment, namely that they learn Arya's Aunt Lysa has died. As a result, Arya can't be reunited with her family, and the Hound can't collect his ransom. Of course, one could classify this as a cliffhanger, as it does lead to similar questions to those posed earlier regarding the schism between Ned and King Robert. But I like to think of this moment with Arya and the Hound as more of a change moment because it arises as the result of new information being presented to both characters. Furthermore, though this change moment does naturally have consequences for plot, I would argue that this is better classified as a change moment because it affects character even more than the plot itself. As a result of the new information that's learned, Arya must come to terms with the loss of yet another family member and what that will mean for her safety. And the Hound must confront a loss of purpose and the fact that he no longer has any real chance of ransoming Arya to anyone for any sort of financial gain. Talk about a change moment. So now that we've explored each of the four core components to scene structure in detail, let's get a quick reminder of each. Again, the four core components are goal, conflict, resolution, and cliffhanger, or, as we've just explored, change moment. To take advantage of this framework, I'd encourage you to set yourself up with an outline for your manuscript that makes sure all four components are present in each scene. When doing so, be sure that the resolutions and cliffhangers tie into goals and conflicts of future scenes as well. Creating an outline like this is a great way to make sure your manuscript scenes serve a purpose throughout the course of your story, while also ensuring they remain engaging to readers. One final bit of advice I've seen out there where scene structure is concerned has to do with what I'll call emotional polarity. The idea behind emotional polarity is that if our perspective character is on the downswing or otherwise feeling negative at the beginning of a scene, by the time that scene is concluded, they should be on the upswing, or generally feeling more positive. As with any writing advice, though, I think it's worth striking a balance in the application of emotional polarity. That is to say, not every scene needs to begin low and end high, or vice versa for that matter. It is something that may be worth keeping in mind while we edit, however, to make sure our scenes aren't always going from negative to positive or positive to negative, which would lead to the kind of predictability that we should be aiming to avoid whenever possible. But alright, that wraps it up for this bonus episode on scene structure. Thanks as always for listening. If you'd like to learn more about scene structure or similar topics, you can always head over to rrcampbellwrites.com and check out the Writing Tips tab. I'd also like to remind listeners that I'm always available as an editor for those of you who are looking for this kind of analysis done on your own work. Right now, I'm offering a free consultation of your manuscript's first 10 pages, so if that sounds like something you might be interested in, you can always reach out to me on Twitter or through my website's contact page at rrcampbellwrites.com. Be sure to stay tuned to Twitter for the chance to vote on future topics for WritesCast episodes by following me or the show at @IamRRCampbell or WritesCast. And you can always subscribe to my newsletter for more tips like these by providing and confirming your email address on the bottom of the homepage at rrcampbellwrites.com. Again, thanks to each and every one of you for listening and for providing your feedback under #WritesCast on Twitter. Next week, we'll hear from author Stephen Salmon on his experience as a writer with cerebral palsy. But until then, you know what to do. Write on and write well.